OWC Radio 2.0, episode number 19, a fun conversation with Larry Jordan. Hey guys, Tim Robertson here with OWC Radio 2.0, episode number 19. Thanks very much for... Let me adjust my mic, guys. All right, there we go. That's a little better. That was probably loud, wasn't it? I apologize for that. Thanks for downloading this episode. Really, really appreciate it. And thank you, first and foremost, for the feedback. I got a couple letters this week that I want to get into. And one of them is going to be a little bit involved. And, you know, it's something that I've been meaning to talk about on this show. And I was kind of looking for an opening. And Janet's email is going to be a perfect segue for it. But first, if you remember right, a couple weeks ago, we did an all gaming podcast. And I asked for feedback on that. And I got a really, really good one from Lee Terry. And Lee writes, this is my second email to you. I am the retired no need to be productive guy. I remember very well. I love that, Lee. You asked for feedback. That still cracks me up. You asked for feedback on your gaming show interview. The background noise was not a problem. However, I vote no to any more gaming as the main topic. There were no arcades around when I grew up, so there was no nostalgia for me. I bought Nintendos and PlayStations for my children, but gaming is not a big part of my life. I listened to the OWC 2.0 podcast for information about Apple technology and products. It was interesting to hear how you use the Voyager to transfer information on hard drives. Upgrading old Macs is good to hear about. How about discussing Apple's new technology like Near Field, which is NFC technology, and if OWC will offer products to use around the house with lights and garage doors. I never write letters to podcasts I don't like. I just stop listening. So do I, by the way. I like the OWC Radio 2.0 podcast, and I am just responding to your request for feedback. Number one, Lee, thanks very much for the feedback. I hear you on the gaming podcast. I did get a few short emails, and it's kind of 50-50. Some people liked it. Some people didn't care for it much. This isn't a gaming-focused podcast, so it's never going to be a big focus of the show. Occasionally, I maybe talk about, you know, some games that's on the Mac, some games that are on the iPad. But for the nostalgia stuff, talking about arcades, no, I'm not going to do a whole lot of that here on OWC Radio. Unless, of course, it has something to do with, let's say, an OWC product. And I'll give you a prime example. And the Voyager was a really good solution for a problem that I was having. Now, I have an arcade cabinet, which is a headless one. It doesn't have a monitor. It's just connected to a big TV. And I was trying to transfer information from my Mac to the PC. Now, the nice thing about the newer tech Voyager, and I've got the one with, it's just USB 3.0. I don't really, for me personally, I don't need the highest speed one because it's just not that important for my workflow. But what I wanted to do was transfer information from my Mac, a lot of information, like 100 gigabytes of data, from my Mac over to the PC. Now, the PC is running Windows 8.1. It's an it's a Dell tower. It's a very quiet tower. It's actually inside the headless arcade, and you never even hear it running. It doesn't get hot in there. It's a pretty decent little PC, and it was an inexpensive one. So I can't really use thumb drives to transfer that information, at least not all at once. I could break up the files in a little bit at a time, and I didn't want to do that. However, the USB 3.0 is perfect. It's on the Mac, it's on the PC, and newer tech Voyager connects via USB. Now, most people think of something like the Voyager as a Mac product. It's an Apple, it works with your iMac, works with your MacBook Pro. That's not necessarily true. I mean, yes, it works with those, but it also works just fine with the PC. As a matter of fact, I had it was an old backup, an old time machine backup hard drive. I wasn't using it for anything. It was just sitting around. I don't know why I didn't repurpose it before, but, and it was like a 250, 300 gig hard drive. So that kind of tells you it's, you know, 5 years old. I popped that into the Voyager on my Mac, went into Disk Utilities and formatted it as an MS FAT. I don't know why they ever call it FAT. A FAT format. In other words, a Windows disk. Copy the information off my Mac to that hard drive, because the Mac will read the FAT hard drive, the PC hard drive, just fine. It'll mount it on the desktop. You can copy to and from it. It's great. So I copied over a little over 100 gigabytes worth of data, unplugged the Voyager from my Mac, plugged it into the PC. It saw the hard drive. It mounted the hard drive on the PC, and I copied it over to the internal drive. The whole thing took 20 minutes tops. Maybe a little longer than that. I didn't do it all in one sitting. I copied it. I left. I did some things, came back, saw that it was done copying, plugged it into the PC, started copying, and walked away again. So actually, I don't know exactly how long it took. It was done copying both times when I came back to the machine. It worked great. I didn't have to go buy a bunch of flash drives. I didn't have to try to break up my files and figure out how many of these files could I fit on the thumb drive and copy it over and then put it all together back on the PC. That would have been a huge pain. I didn't want to do that. The newer Tech Voyager allowed me to do exactly what I was doing, what I wanted to do, really easily. In fact, it was so easy, I'm starting to think maybe I ought to pick up another Voyager and just the USB 3 one and permanently put it in my arcade cabinet. Now, there won't be a hard drive sitting in it most of the time. It's just for data transfer. But then again, I don't have a backup solution running on that PC. So maybe I'll just I can't use the repurposed drive because it's not big enough. It's got a 1 terabyte drive in that PC. So I might just go pick up at OWC a bare hard drive, not one in a closure, just a hard drive, and the Voyager, stick it in there, put the hard drive in it, and that will just be the backup window uses to back up that machine. And then when I do need to transfer something, I can just pop that out of the top of the Voyager and put the other hard drive that I'm transferring the data from or to. That might work really well. I think I'm going to do that. I think that's probably a pretty elegant solution. What I don't want to do is have to plug and unplug a USB 3 cable into that thing all the time, because, again, it's inside of a cabinet, inside of this arcade cabinet. And getting to the back of the PC is really a pain. It really is. I got to move it. I got to kind of tilt it. I can't see very well. I did put a light in there, but it doesn't really help a whole lot for where the ports are on the PC. But if I just have a newer Tech Voyager permanently plugged into it, that's pretty cool. I think that might be the way I go. So Lee, as to your suggestion, yes, it's not going to happen the way it did before. I really enjoyed doing that podcast, but it really doesn't fit the format of OWC Radio. I'd like to have him back on and talk about more appropriate games for the Mac and the iOS and stuff like that. And it'd probably be a segment. But if Apple comes out with what I've talked about on the show before, what I'd really like to see, an Apple TV with apps and games, that would be cool, and that would be an appropriate conversation for the podcast. And we'll look at something like that in the future. But, you know, that real focused gaming podcast for the entire episode, I know I probably won't do that again. Hold on, have to get a little caffeine. That's one of the things when I'm doing a solo show, and it's like an hour, finding a place to stop and take a drink of something to lubricate the throat isn't always easy. There's no way of doing it unless there's a pregnant pause there. And I don't want to edit it, stop recording, take a drink, come back and this is a podcast. And it's real people having real conversations, which is what I'm going to do on the second half of this episode. I had a lot of fun, honestly, with Larry Jordan. He's a character. And he's really good at what he does. And I hope you enjoy the conversation that we have. And again, that's going to be in the second half of the show. You remember I was saying there was topics that I wanted to talk about, but I couldn't really figure out a good segue to bring them up. And Janet Rosen sent in a really great email that I think a lot of people are like this. She writes, I have been using a Mac for almost 20 years, but I really don't understand much about it as far as how it does what it does. Why is RAM more important? What's the difference between memory and a hard drive? Why is SSD better? I would love to know more about the inner workings of my Mac, but I am not a techie and never really researched it. Can you explain all of this in layman's terms? Janet. Well, Janet, yeah, I can. But it's a challenge in that, where do I start? So when I was in the shower this morning, I was really thinking about your email and how I could really explain it. And I think I came up with kind of a neat metaphor. And I hope this helps you and anybody else who, you know, you're a computer user, you're a Mac user, you use these machines, but you really don't understand RAM and hard drives and bus speeds and what all this stuff means and what all these numbers mean. And I'm going to try to keep this very grounded, and I'm going to use metaphors, and I hope this helps. So let's start with the hard drive. Now, a conventional hard drive with the spinning platters, the ones that's been in computers since the dawn of time, think about those as a very rustic, what's the word I'm looking for? Old West town, okay? Where it's a really big town, but it has dirt roads. And getting from place to place is easy, but it's dirt roads and it doesn't go real, you can't really go fast. So that's what the hard drive, conventional hard drives were. Now, as they got better and faster, you know, they improved the dirt roads. They put the oil down on top of the dirt roads so it wasn't so dusty. The houses got a little bit closer together, so it didn't take quite as long from going from one place to another. But it's still a little bit pokey. Even the faster conventional hard drives compared to an SSD, just they're really not as fast. You can't really compare them. Okay, so that's a conventional hard drive. An SSD, however, is a truly metropolitan city. It's got paved roads. It's got bullet trains going from house to house, that sort of thing. It's very, very fast. It doesn't take hardly any time at all to get from one residence in this town to another. It's really the difference between a 19th century town and a 21st century town. It's that big of a difference. It does make getting around a lot faster. Okay? So hopefully that will give you the idea between the difference between a conventional hard drive and an SSD. Now, how does that help your Mac? Let's back up a little bit and look at what a processor is. A processor, for instance, in the current Macs, it's all the Intel i3s, i5s, i7s, those types of processors. Way back in the day, it was a 6800K chips. It was the IBM G5s, G4s. Those are all processors. That's where all the math happens. That's what really does everything on your computer. That's where the magic happens. That's where the programs go to do what they do. Of course, it's all math. It's, you know, if this, then that. It's equations. And a processor, the faster the processor is, the faster it can do these very complex math problems, and the program runs the way it's supposed to run. Now, here was the problem. You want to get the information from the hard drive to the processor. Except the processor itself doesn't hold information. It has to work with whatever's on the hard drive itself. But it can't because the hard drive is just too slow. Even an SSD, as fast as they are, really isn't fast enough for a processor. So it needs something else. It needs a place that's lightning fast that it can store these programs while it works on them. And that's memory. That's RAM. So what your hard drive does, what your processor does is it goes to the Old West town and it says, hey, I need Adobe Photoshop. Give it to me. And of course, the hard drive pokes around, finds all the little bits and pieces for this whole thing. It says, here you go. It travels on a bus. Bus speeds. That's the way the information gets from the hard drive to wherever it needs to go. In this case, memory, RAM. So it takes this bus speed. Bus speeds today are very fast, and there's different types of bus speeds, and we're not going to talk about that right now, but it takes this bus to the memory, to the RAM. Now, the RAM, of course, is very, very fast, and the processor can do what it needs to do with the program, with the files loaded into RAM. It can access things, it can move things around, it's just great. And when you hit save, that program, those files, again, go the opposite way. They get back on the bus and they go back to the hard drives and they park themselves there again. You just saved a file. Here's the problem. The bottleneck at that point is the hard drive. Because it's an old West town, it has dirt roads, and as the processor is sitting there waiting for the information to go from the hard drive to the RAM, there's a delay. With an SSD, there's hardly any delay. It goes to the SSD hard drive and says, I need this. And it says, yep, there you go. There it is. Conventional hard drive goes, you need what? Yeah, okay, hold on. Let me look for all the pieces. And there's this, and there's this, and there's this. Give me a second. There's this, and there you go. So the difference between pulling the information off of one drive, like a conventional hard drive, and an SSD is just night and day. The SSD just says, yep, there it is. Go ahead. And it takes that and it loads it into memory, and everything just happens faster. Now, when you boot up your computer, remember, there's nothing in the RAM. Nothing. So when it's booting up, it literally has to pull the entire operating system and everything that computer needs to operate from the hard drive, and it loads it into RAM. So before you even launch one program on your computer, a lot of your RAM is already being taken up by the operating system itself, whether it's the Mac, whether it's Linux, whether it's Windows, whether it's iOS, whether it's Android. Those are all operating systems that have to be loaded into RAM for the processor to work with. So let's say you have 2 gigs of RAM and your operating system takes up two-thirds of it, or a half of it, or however much it takes. But in our case, you have 2 gigs of RAM, and your operating system's going to take a quarter of that memory just for itself. So as it boots up, your 2 gigs of RAM is now 1.5 gigs of available RAM. Any program that you launch, from a web browser to email to iPhoto to Final Cut Pro, to whatever you load, has to load into RAM. Now, obviously, the computer wants as much as it can get into the RAM because, hey, I'm going to be using these programs all the time. As you switch programs, I want it all in RAM so I can quickly switch from one program to the other. There's no delay. I can just start working with that program. In fact, modern computers can do stuff in the background. So as it's using one program in the foreground, it's still doing stuff in the background, like refreshing a web browser, playing music. On a phone, it's GPS and playing music, and you might be talking on the phone. The GPS is still in contact and knows exactly where you are, so when you hang up, you're not lost. So it does a lot of things. But again, it has to load all these programs into RAM, into memory. So what happens when you've loaded too much into your RAM? Well, then the hard drive comes back into play. The processor says, look, we've only got this much space, fellas. Some of you are going to have to wait on the hard drive. Some of you are going to have to wait in RAM. Hopefully, the operator will only use the stuff that's loaded into RAM, because if he doesn't, I have to pull something else out of RAM, put you back on the hard drive, go back to the hard drive, pull the program he wants, which is already running, by the way, but it's on the hard drive. I put it back into RAM, and then I'll start working with it again. So it's swapping the data back and forth, and it slows you down, especially with a conventional hard drive. With an SSD, it's not quite as bad. It's swapping the information, but it's very fast. Are you with me so far? I hope I'm not making this more complex than I'm attempting to. So you have the processor. It has to have RAM to run any program in, because hard drives and SSDs are just too slow. You have the hard drives, the conventional ones, which is, you know, the old West town with dirt roads, and the SSD, which is a modern metropolis with maglift drives and self-driving cars, and it's extremely fast. And then, of course, you have the RAM where everything happens. That's where the programs go to do what they're going to do. So if you run out of RAM space, you don't have enough memory. In some programs, you may not even be able to load into RAM at all. It may take way too much RAM than you have in your machine. I used to have that problem with Photoshop on an old Mac. It required something like, 250 megabytes to run of RAM, and I didn't have that much. And there was programs that would trick the processor into allowing you to, let's not get into that right now. Let's stick with the current metaphor. So what happens when you run out of RAM? It starts swapping the information back and forth from the hard drive. And what does that do? As we know, it slows you way down. So if you upgrade your RAM, instead of having the 2 gigabytes of RAM, you upgrade it to, let's say, 16 gigabytes of RAM. Now the processor is very happy because it can load all these programs from your SSD or your conventional hard drive into RAM, and it doesn't have to swap all the time with your hard drive. It just uses what's in the RAM, what's in the memory, and everything is much faster. So that's why for years and years and years, people said the most important upgrade that you can do to your computer is to put more RAM into it. Nowadays, I think it's probably as equally as important to have an SSD and upgrade your RAM. Because once again, with a conventional hard drive, the bottleneck is going to be pulling the information from the hard drive and loading it into RAM. That's the little icons bouncing in your dock. That's what's happening right then. When you click it, the processor went to the hard drive and it's moving the files from the hard drive to the memory, to the RAM, where it can actually do things with it. When you hit save, it takes it from memory and saves a copy to your hard drive. Not the entire program, just the file that you're working with. But every time you turn off your computer, anything in RAM, in memory, it's gone, including your operating system. When you start up a machine with a conventional hard drive, that operating system takes a lot of space and it takes a lot of RAM, and it has to load the entire operating system into the memory before the computer will do anything. That's why booting up with a conventional hard drive takes a lot longer. With an SSD, it has to do the same thing. It has to take the entire operating system, the networking, the graphical user interface, the everything, and it has to load it into RAM. But if you're coming from an SSD, it's a whole lot faster, an order of magnitude faster. So that's why I tell people, if you want to make your older machine feel like a blazingly fast, newer machine, max out your RAM, because each Mac can only take a certain amount of RAM, and put an SSD in it. That way, your machine is going to run just a ton faster. It really will. There's no comparison. I hope that, my explanation helped you, Janet. I really do. It was the best metaphor I could come up with in the shower. The old West town compared to a major metropolitan area. If that made sense to you guys, let me know. If I lost you, let me know. Because if you like that metaphor, I can use something similar to start talking about, some of the newer technologies that you may not understand, like Thunderbolt. Why is that a big deal? What are bus speeds and why are, things connected to Thunderbolt so much faster? Why is having a RAID 5 so much better than just a conventional hard drive? Why can it write faster to a RAID than a conventional hard drive? I've got metaphors for those I think I can use as well to explain it. But if you guys find that boring and you don't want to hear about it, let me know. But if you want to learn about stuff like that, I hope that my weak attempt at metaphors make it a little bit easier. And if I make a mistake on how I'm explaining something, let me know. Because, I'm not the most tech-heavy person in the entire world. I know how things work, but that doesn't necessarily mean I can always explain it in layman's terms. The reason for that is I've been in this industry for a very long time. I've written, probably a million words at this point about Apple and the Mac and iPhones and iPads and reviews. And sometimes I forget that not everybody has been doing that as long as I have, or that some people don't really care, or no one's ever taken the time to explain it in a way that will make sense to them. And that's what I was trying to attempt here. I hope I didn't fail. I hope that you guys followed all that. So if you still have a Mac with a conventional hard drive and the minimum amount of RAM in it, and you're really not keen on buying a brand new Mac, really consider upgrading the RAM and the hard drive. Get a SSD and more memory, and you will see a significant improvement on your Mac. And look, if you're worried about doing it yourself, we've got step-by-step videos that you could watch on your iPad while you're upgrading your Mac. You can pause the video, follow step-by-step, and we sell the tools to do it. We sell the hard drives, SSDs, the RAM. We really do have you covered at Otherworld Computing. So go to MacSales.com. Find the upgrades for your computer. Find out how much it's going to cost. Look at the installation videos before you even buy to make sure that you're comfortable doing it. And really take the plunge, because the difference between what you have now and what you'll have after these upgrades, it's just night and day. It really is. So coming up is Larry Jordan. You know, Larry's done a podcast. The podcast itself has been around. He says it's the second oldest podcast in the world, which is amazing. Now, podcasting has been going for about 10 years now. I started podcasting about 10 years ago myself. Initially, as some of you may know, I started the My Mac podcast, and I had a lot of fun. And it was through that show, honestly, that I got to know Larry O'Connor, the founder of OWC, by doing interviews with him at the Macworld Expo. I actually went to their headquarters at that time for a while there and did an interview for the My Mac podcast there. And I got to know Larry. I got to know some of his team. I saw the working environment, and I really fell in love with the company. And it was because of that show directly that I'm doing OWC Radio. That's why I'm an employee of Otherworld Computing now. I do the social media, as I've talked about in the past. And I go to these different events. And as it comes a little bit closer, and we've got a couple coming up where I'm going to be at an event, or OWC is going to be out at an event, I'm going to talk about it here on the show, encourage you guys to come out to the show, meet us, see the products in person, and possibly if I'm at the show too, get you on the podcast, because again, I think that would be just killer. So wherever you live out there, Janet, if you want to be on the show and we're gonna be in your area, listen to the show and let me know. Same thing with you, Lee, because as we both know, you don't have to be productive anymore. So, you know, you can come out to the show and do a meet and greet with us. No need to be productive. But, you know, I've been podcasting myself for 10 years. I love this medium. And Larry Jordan and I go into a fun conversation. I wasn't expecting at the beginning of this conversation with him about the disruptive technologies out there, how really no podcasts out there are doing it for the money, because there really isn't a whole lot of money in podcasting yet. And I say yet because I think eventually there will be, and that's starting to turn around. I've been reading some reports. But Larry is a very, very interesting guy. I think that you guys are really going to get a kick out of listening to him. I know I had a great time talking to him. Now, Larry's one of those people I did not know. I've never met him in person. I don't think we've ever communicated online. So the first time that we talked was right here on this show. We talked for maybe 2 or 3 minutes before we hit record. So my conversation with Larry is fun for me. It's someone I don't know. I was very interested in learning what he does and how he does, and the journey he got from where he started to where he is now, and his take on what's coming up in technology. And it was fun. It was a great conversation. I hope that you enjoy it. If you do, make sure you go to blog.macsales.com. Go to episode number 19, and I have links for everything that Larry and I talk about during that conversation. So if you want to go to check out his YouTube channel, there's a lot of stuff up there. If you want to follow him on Twitter, you want to take one of his classes, all those links are going to be in the show notes for episode number 19 at blog.macsales.com. And if you're online anyways, follow us on Twitter. You know, I'm the one that's doing the postings on Twitter. So it's not like some companies, some of these big companies, you can kind of tell it's not necessarily a robot, but they're going by script. This is what we're going to post for the next 15 weeks. We don't do that at OWC. It's a real person. It's real people at the company. We care about our clients and our customers. We want to take care of you guys, and we want to make you happy. And I also like to have conversations with people. And if you want to have a conversation with me in real time, Twitter. It's a perfect example that I monitor it all day long, morning, noon, and night. And when people post there, I'm the person that's going to respond to you. So reach out on Twitter and say hi. We're at MacSales, MacSales, at MacSales on Twitter. We also do the Facebook, of course. It's facebook.com/OWC MacSales. So reach out, say hi, and if you're interested in coming on the show, let me know, because we've got some interviews and conversations coming up with everyday people just like you and me, and it's just going to be a conversation of how they got into the Mac, what do they do with it currently, what is their day job, just fun learning, meeting other people with common interests. And I honestly love those kind of conversations and those interviews. They're just a lot of fun for me, and I hope that you guys like them too. So with that, I'm going to wrap up this segment of OWC Radio 2.0, episode number 19. The email address, if you'd like to reach out like Janet did today and ask a question, or if you have a suggestion like Lee had today about pulling back a little bit from the gaming stuff, let me know. It's owcradio@macsales.com. And of course, make sure you go to macsales.com for all the upgrades and peripherals and cases and all the cool stuff that we sell up at macsales.com. Go check it out. And I will see you in a week. And welcome back to OWC Radio 2.0. Like I said in the first segment, I've got a special guest. His name is Larry Jordan. And I was kind of explaining how long I was podcasting in the first segment, which is about 10 years. Kind of goes back to the beginning of podcasting, but there's somebody else that's been doing it even longer, and that's Larry Jordan. Larry, how long have you been podcasting?
Well, we're not exactly sure. We know that Adam Curry started the first podcast called All Things Digital in May. And we were the second. We started in September, founded by two guys, Steve Martin and Ron Margolis, who handed it over to Phil Hodgetts, and Phil ran it for a couple of years, and I took the podcast over 6 years ago now. So we've been on the air for 10 years, although there's some debate in the murkiness of time in terms of exactly when Adam started. We just know that we were number two.
That's pretty awesome.
Tim, it's wonderful to be on the show. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on. You've got a great business. A lot of people that listen to the show are both professional and amateur, let's say videographers. They like to edit. They like to shoot. But a lot of the people that are shooting video, when they get it back to their computer, they're not very good at, making the most of that footage. That's kind of where you come in, isn't it?
Well, if you think about it, back when you were young, which looking at your picture was about 2 weeks ago.
I wish.
We told stories with words. And increasingly, words are still important, but not ink on paper, not words on a page. Words are important in media. We're telling stories with pictures and with your podcast. We're telling stories in sound. And what we're discovering is that so many people have been consuming video for a long time, but they don't know how to use video for storytelling, and that's where I help. I can help amateur and professional video editors and filmmakers tell stories with pictures, whether it's in understanding the technology or understanding the craft of editing, and my company's been doing that now. December is our 10th anniversary. We're all looking forward to having a birthday cake, and then I'm forcing everybody to go back to work.
Of course, that's what they're there for. You don't pay them to eat cake. So that's Larry Jordan Associates at larryjordan.biz, B-I-Z.
Yeah, for some reason, I can't get com. Somebody else owns it and won't sell it to me.
Larry Jordan, We could probably pay the certain people enough money and we can get it back for you.
Yes. I got this message from a guy saying, you can buy larryjordan.com. it's only $17,000.
Is that what they're really asking?
I said, $17,000. Wow. He said, yes, it's a very famous name, and you need to pay extra for it. Well, why is it a famous name, I ask myself. But that's a road down which I will not go. It's just too depressing.
So what got you into training? I mean, what was the impetus to get you to want to start a business to train other people in editing and using the software that's available out there?
I couldn't get a job.
No?
No, it was sad.
I don't believe that for a moment.
I had my career has run in three broad phases. The first phase was broadcast television, starting right out of graduate school at University of Wisconsin. I got a job at a beautiful music station in northern Illinois, Rockton, Illinois, WRWC. I was broadcasting to cattle and sheep, but I was having a great time. I was in hog heaven. Every 15 minutes, I would get on the radio and I'd say, ladies and gentlemen, that is the Mantovani Strings. Coming up next, the Boston Pops. 15 minutes later, I would say, that was the Boston Pops. Coming up next, Mantovani Strings. And then on the hour, I would do a 90-second rip and read newscast. Rip and read because we would rip it from the teletype, which printed the news on paper. It's like the internet, only more archaic. And I would do this newscast for 90 seconds, and it was like I owned the world.
I'm going to say this was the 70s.
And it lasted for 2 months. Program director called me into his office. Son, he said, because I was younger then. Son, he said, you are a second tenor. We need a baritone. Enjoy the rest of your life. And that quickly, the door slammed shut on my radio career. Fortunately, the same day that I got fired in radio, I was hired as a camera operator at WHA Television Madison, the University of Wisconsin, and switched in a heartbeat from radio to TV, and I've been in TV for 40 years since then. So, you know, when a door slams shut in your face, a window opens. But, Tim, I will tell you this. It was so damaging to my ego to be accused of being a second tenor that every morning when I wake up, I look at myself in a mirror, and I say, are you all right? And I have worked for 40 years to pitch my voice three notes lower, so when radio calls, will be ready.
Now, how has the technology changed in your mind? Obviously, you've seen the rise of the internet. You've seen the rise of almost free distribution, a democratization, really, of content. And now, of course, we have podcasting, which has been going on for about 10 years, a little over 10 years. You've returned to the radio, except it's not radio waves, it's over the internet. You have a broader reach than you ever did up there in Wisconsin. What's that done for the ego for you?
Well, the ego is not any bigger than anybody else's ego, I don't think.
Mine's pretty big.
Yeah.
My wife says that anyways.
You're young, you've got room to control it. When I was doing broadcast television, I went from Wisconsin to Montana, Montana to Maryland, Maryland to Massachusetts, and did everything from single-camera local station to network telecasts. But when I was doing a lot of heavy broadcasting in Boston, the only way I could transmit a television signal was with a 25-foot bread truck, a crew of $4.5 million worth of gear in that truck. And that was just for a single camera. Now, when I put my laptop in my computer bag and throw it over my shoulder, I have more video power in that laptop than I ever had in a $500,000 remote truck that I traveled around the Massachusetts area with. The technology has become more accessible, but that does not necessarily mean that the people with the technology have the skills to know how to use it.
Or some of them should do anything with it.
Well, I mean, we could argue that back in the days of journalism in the 1920s and the 1930s, that people should not have had access to printing presses. I mean, there's always people who are writing or recording stuff with which you disagree or you feel should not be given permission to air their opinions. That's been true since we've had painting on rock walls. The issue really is, how do you powerfully communicate your ideas using non-written means. And that is a skill set that all of us are still struggling to invent. And what we're seeing is that the democratization of media and the virtually free distribution is destroying institutions in this country, which there is no countervailing counterpoint to. For instance, newspapers have lost a huge amount of their influence in being able to monitor and shape public officials in terms of being able to call attention to issues which the public needs to know about. And we could have a debate, and it would be worth talking about, whether the rise of citizen journalism carries the same gravitas, the same impact that the New York Times headlining an abuse of power does. I think that with democratization becomes a weakening of individual voices such that it's harder to call attention to problems because the noise level has increased so much. It's the law of unintended consequences. Simply because you have the technology, more people have the technology, more people are using the technology, which diminishes everybody's voice. I think we're going through a very interesting sociological time right now for instance, again, just to look at you, Tim, your podcast is a wonderful program, like an outstanding vehicle for people to learn more about both OWC and interesting people that you come across in your interviews. But you're not making money from your podcast. You're making money from other venues, either general sales for the corporation or other work. I mean, the podcast itself does not generate the money necessary to sustain your time should you need to live on it. This is true of every podcast. There's almost no podcast on the planet that generates enough revenue to sustain the people that are creating it. They're all labors of love.
Now, do you think that's because they're just not being run from a business perspective, or do you think it's because advertisers don't take the medium seriously yet?
Or three, people believe that information on the internet should be free.
Sure.
And if that's the case, how do you sustain a business model when your principal reason for living, delivering information, is viewed as something that should be free? We don't have an answer for that one yet.
By the same token, newspapers never had subscriptions or buying it at the newsstand. That's not how they made their revenue. That was almost inconsequential to their bottom line. Their bottom line came from selling ads.
A better way to put it is, like any broadcast media, whether it's radio, television, or newspapers, what the newspaper did is deliver an audience to an advertiser.
Correct.
The way that broadcast television delivers an audience to an advertiser.
That's right.
Now, look at your ad levels. If you were to sell advertising on your podcast, could you equal the levels of broadcast TV or even broadcast radio? And the answer is no. So partly it's a lack of audience. I'm not saying you have a small audience. That's not at all what I'm saying. But what I am saying is that advertisers don't view podcast audiences with the same revenue that they view broadcast radio or broadcast television. So what we're seeing is, one, advertisers are discounting the product. Two, the product is so fragmented that it doesn't deliver large audiences. I have a YouTube channel. It's Larry Jordan FCP. The YouTube channel is I've had 2 million views on my YouTube channel, and it's growing about 20 to 30,000 views a week. So I'm doing pretty good on YouTube. And I did some measurements to see how much money I make from my YouTube channel, because like most people, I have ads turned on, a process called monetization. I make $100 for every 100,000 views. $100 for every 100,000 views does not sustain a company.
No, not even close.
But 100,000 views is bragging rights, but bragging rights doesn't pay the rent. So what we're struck with here is a very interesting business model where information is easy to disseminate. We have virtually unlimited, highly powerful, high-quality distribution mechanisms, and the only people making money are not the people creating the content, but the people that own the distribution systems that are selling the advertising. This is a strange business model.
It absolutely is, but do you think that that's only because we're in the transitional period still? I mean, television ad revenue didn't even come close to radios for almost 20 years. And of course, nowadays, you couldn't even get more different. Podcasting, YouTube channels, all of this was invented and became popular within just the last decade. What do you think it's going to look like a decade from now?
You know, that's a really good question. I have trouble predicting tomorrow for breakfast.
Me too. So. That's why I was hoping you could tell me.
I think what we're seeing, I'm reading a couple of really interesting books, but the idea of the law of unintended consequences, or another book that I'm reading, which is How We Got to Now, talks about the fact that the invention of glass led to eyeglasses, led to microscopes, led to telescopes, which then revealed new facets of nature that nobody expected a simple transparent material that you would put in look through, like a window. All of a sudden, the window is taking us to the farthest reaches of outer space and the innermost reaches of the human body in a way that nobody could have anticipated when glass was invented. I think we're in the exact same situation here. People that are making hardware are able to make money because it's a physical entity that you can hold in your hands. And as we all know, people will pay more for something they can touch than a concept like a web page they can download. So the challenge is for hardware people like OWC to get their voice heard to the broader market so that people buy, say, OWC products versus, you know, somebody else like G Technology or LaCie or the other folks that sell products similar to what OWC does. So there's the marketing challenge. But there is an implicit understanding that hardware commands a physical price because it's an object you hold. That understanding has been shattered because in the past, the only way that we could get information from a newspaper is to buy the physical entity of a newspaper. Now, we can get access to the content that a newspaper contains. The physical entity becomes irrelevant. We don't need the physical subscription. We can read it on the web. And there's always been a disconnect that the information was embedded in the hardware. So when we buy the hardware, we got the information. Now that they're separate, people are saying, well, wait a minute, I don't have to buy the hardware. Why do I pay for the information? Yet the cost is not in the hardware. The cost is the information that the hardware contained. This is a disconnect that's going to take us a long while to figure out.
I agree. It's a fascinating topic. I'd love to spend another hour talking about it, but we're really here to talk about you. And I'm curious on how you got from being a Badger way up there in Wisconsin, all the way to L.A. now. And how long have you been in L.A.?
Oh, that's a story from a checkered past. You know, I've spent my life looking for steady work, and it wasn't until, probably 10 years ago that I found it. When I was in high school, I had told my parents moved a lot. And when I was in high school...
Military dad?
Pardon?
Military dad?
No, my dad was a Methodist minister.
Okay.
And the church in those days believed that reassigning pastors every year or two was a good thing. And when I was a senior in high school, I was living in my 14th house in my 12th city.
Wow.
So I just assumed growing up that one picked up one's roots and moved on a regular basis. I still have a very hard time answering the question, what's your hometown? So that continued because in television, especially in production, you're a gypsy. You move from one town to another and one job to another.
Trying to get to the bigger market.
Always trying to step up to the bigger market because you don't get promoted within the station. You jump from one station to another. And when I finally got off that merry-go-round, I was doing work for both ABC and the ABC station in Boston. And that ended the first section of my career, which is broadcast television. I'm a producer and director, a member of both the Producers Guild and the Directors Guild. And I had the first 15 to 20 years of my career was all wrapped around live, multi-camera broadcast TV. Then I shifted gears for reasons to this very day that are still murky and got involved with software development. I wrote my own software marketing. I worked for a variety of companies that marketed software, really wrapped around what was the hot topic of the 1980s and 90s, which was digital publishing, the ability to take images and instead of having them be on a camera, put those images first black and white and then color on a computer and then be able to print those images out, what we call desktop publishing, which was the cutting edge then because we couldn't figure out how to get color on the computer to match color on a printing press because they used two different color spaces. That lasted for about 15, 20 years and then I realized that I wanted to do something different, but I had moved from the East Coast to the West Coast. And television is very much a business where people hire people they know. And nobody knew me out here. So I tried to get a job as a director, but it was going to take forever to get people to know who I was. And I needed to eat. The family refused to stop eating for 6 months. So I couldn't get a job as a director, so I said I'll produce. And producers are really useful people, but their projects take years to develop. And I had that ever-present problem of food and rent, so producing was out. So I said I'll edit. But nobody wants to hire an editor till they've had a chance to see if they can edit. So again, we had this time delay issue, which was a clock ticking in the background. So I said, well, if I can't direct and I can't produce and I can't eat, then I'll teach. And I became certified to teach Final Cut. And from that one step of becoming certified to teach Final Cut Pro, which was version 1.2 at that time back in 1999, from that, my entire business has grown. We're now teaching Adobe and Apple products. We teach around the world. We have websites that have got thousands of technical articles. We have people that tune in for weekly video webinars. I've written 8 books on Final Cut and Adobe Premiere. We've probably got the industry leading training on Final Cut. It has been an amazing 10 years. There's now 10 people in our company, and we're continuing to grow. It's been phenomenal.
So you've almost, I don't want to say you kind of fell into it backwards, but in a way you kind of did. It wasn't really what you were setting out to do, but mm-hmm. This is what you became. Do you consider yourself a teacher now? I mean, obviously you've written 8 books, and these are all to teach people how to apply their craft. Are you a teacher now? Is that what you do?
It's part of what I do. My company's motto is that we help editors get work, improve their skills, and keep clients happy. We're very much a service organization, which is focused on enabling people to do better, which I really respond to. I like considering that what we do helps other people. Part of what we do is teaching, and I've been told that I'm a pretty good teacher. I take that as a high compliment. I think teaching is a gift which enables, as the saying says, give a man a fish, he eats for a day. Teach a man to fish, and he eats for a lifetime. I think teachers enable us to achieve things for the rest of our life.
I totally agree.
It's hard to not be excited about something.
And, you know, teachers, I found in my life, my favorite teachers, the ones who I think did the best jobs, were themselves storytellers. And being a storyteller and a teacher allows them to capture their audience, their students' imaginations or their attention, and thus we're able to absorb more and learn more. And having listened to your show, Digital Production Buzz, which we'll get to in a minute, you're a storyteller at heart, and that transitions very well into teaching. Now, does that also translate to you, for you, in the printed word? Is it the same type of activity when you're writing a book or teaching a class?
I think that if I've got one gift, it's that I can communicate very, very complex technical subjects in a way that most people can understand. And the way you do that is you take the fear away. The fear of learning something new, the fear that you're not smart enough to understand it, the fear that everybody else will be laughing at you because you're too far behind. Fear is the biggest impediment to learning that there is. And my job is to take that fear away. Second is to explain this technology in a way that makes sense. Now, Tim, I won't put you on the spot, but I will bet that there are questions of how a microprocessor does its operations that you probably don't understand and couldn't explain if somebody asked you to. Mm-hmm. There's an element where at some point technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Absolutely.
As Clark said. What I want to do is I want to demystify the magic to the point that you feel that you're in control of the operation of that technology. You may not understand how the microprocessor works at the deepest level, but you understand what it's doing, how it fits into the overall architecture of your computer, and when you need to worry about the microprocessor, and when you need to worry about the GPU, and when it's a RAM issue, and when it's a storage issue. You understand those basic components, so you don't feel you're looking at this indecipherable box, but you're back in control. And that, I think, is the goal of teaching. To enable you to feel that you're in control of the tools that you're using and you're able to use those tools effectively.
How has a change of technology just in the last few years affected what you do? Let's be honest, the iPhone doesn't come close to a really great DSL or a production quality video camera, but it does a pretty darn good job and a lot of people are using them. GoPros, same thing. I mean, they're shooting at some of them now, 1080p, 4K. Aerial footage. It's so different than what it used to be, these small devices. But yet, at the end of the day, they still need to edit. So how has the rise of these new technologies that didn't really exist 10 years ago, how has that affected what you do? Has it increased the number of people wanting to take your classes? Has it made you offer different types of classes, more beginner stuff that you would have probably not have offered before?
I think everybody's a beginner at some point. And the hardest part of any teaching, the absolute hardest part, is explaining to somebody that doesn't know how to start, how to get started.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to explain deep, advanced concepts to people that already understand because they're building on a foundation that you can leverage. This is like this or this is like that. But where you don't even know exactly where to click the mouse to start the application, or worse, you start the application and you don't even know how do I enter my name? How do I enter my phone number? For instance, with Skype, how do I find you so we can connect? Well, I was looking you up under Timothy. Well, Timothy doesn't show up, so I can't even have this conversation with you because I was searching for you using the wrong name.
Correct.
And I was just, it was Skype's fault, of course, because it wasn't my fault that I didn't know you were called Tim. So all of a sudden, the technology gets in the way and prevents us from getting stuff done. My goal is to have that technology become invisible and then to enable you to understand the craft of telling stories, or enable you to understand the craft of layering audio to create a particular mood, or to understand how to use that technology to create the effects that you want, or to edit the shots that you need together to get the emotional response you need. I teach at USC, and I teach my class that are non-editors. I don't teach at the film school. I teach in the engineering school. And I tell my class, none of you guys are going to be professional editors, but every single one of you is going to need to communicate ideas using pictures to people that you need to persuade to your point of view. And how are you going to do that if you don't understand how visual communication works? How are you going to do that if you don't understand how the tools you're using work? You're setting yourself up for failure. You're spending a fortune to attend a really high-quality school, and you don't understand the basic tools of communication. And you could see it all of a sudden, their eyes would light up and they would nod their head, say, wait a minute, that's right.
Yeah.
I understand theory, but I don't understand practice. Let me just give you one more story, Tim, and I'll let you ask your question. The most powerful, the most influential class that I have ever had in my life was learning how to type in high school. Now, we didn't type anything in particular, but learning how to use 10 fingers on the keyboard and to type on a typewriter has driven everything else that I've ever done in my life. The books that I write, the articles that I write, being able to be facile with a computer, was all based on that one simple technology course of demystifying a keyboard. That's what we need to do with visual communications as well. Demystify it and enable you to become the creative person that you want to be.
I flunked that class, by the way. My typing class with the IBM Selectric. I had to teach myself many years later. I wish I would have paid more attention, to be honest. It would have accelerated what I really wanted to be doing later in life instead of hunting and pecking for keys until eventually I got to where I am today, where I can go about, I don't know, 80, 90 words a minute. Now, you started with Final Cut at version 2.
1.2.
How often do you have to learn to be able to teach? Because obviously you're building on that foundation and you really only need to learn what's different between this version and the next version, but how much education do you give yourself to be able to teach others?
Every day, 2 or 3 hours a day. This industry is changing so quickly that just to be able to keep on top of it is a never-ending process of learning. It's one of the reasons I do the weekly seminars, is it forces me to stay on top of this. I mean, Adobe last week updated every single one of their Creative Cloud applications. That's 20 new pieces of software just hit the market, of which 6 directly impact what I teach. Premiere, Prelude, Audition, Adobe Media Encoder, After Effects. Photoshop, one could argue. And these have got major substantial new features, major new codec support, new output options, new connectivity options, new hardware. I mean, all of a sudden, boom, 20 new pieces of software. Now, Apple's going to do the exact same thing.
Yep.
We've got a new operating system from Apple coming soon. We just got iOS 8. More and more people are integrating iOS devices with video editing. How do we get those files moved across? And how about the new codecs and Apple and Adobe's new support for Cineform? Where does Cineform fit in with a standard workflow for an amateur or a professional? And what happens if you're using, the knowledge is exploding, and people expect me to have the answer. And I enjoy doing the homework to say, this is how this works. This is what you need to know. But it is a never-ending process of trying to figure this stuff out.
Do you like it?
Love it.
Yeah?
I'm frustrated with it. I keep feeling like I can't absorb this stuff fast enough. You can only suck it in so quickly, and then you have to assimilate it and be able to explain it to other people. I love the challenge, but there are times where it is frustrating trying to stay on top of an industry that just refuses to hold still.
What happens to a company like yours and the courses that you teach when Apple comes out with Final Cut 10, Final Cut X, where it's a completely different interface? The workflows are completely broken. Even the old files can't be opened in this new application. How long does it take you to start offering the new courses in that new version? And how long do you keep the other versions going in training? Because I know there's still a lot of people who won't go over to the new Final Cut. They're still using that classic version.
Everything I've ever offered for training is available on my website. Final Cut 5, Final Cut 6, Final Cut 7, Final Cut 10.0, and now the current version, 10.1x. So my feeling is you don't have to migrate. I will support you and give you the training that you need. Adobe CS6, CS5, 5, CC, CC2, 2014, 2014.1. We'll give you the support on all the different versions. You can dial into whatever you need. In terms of learning the new version, I had 3 weeks.
Wow. Jeez, that's not enough time, Larry.
There was some level of pressure behind that.
Just a little bit. Did you sleep much? I know I wouldn't have.
A good friend of mine, Bruce Nazarian, has a line that I steal on a regular basis. We'll sleep when we're dead.
Yeah, I've heard that many times myself. What is the Digital Production Buzz?
Digital Production Buzz is a podcast which is specifically focused on media production, post-production, and distribution all around the world. Our goal is to help filmmakers and visual storytellers understanding the craft of editing, understand the business of creating films, understand how to produce movies, how to edit movies, and how to distribute them so you can make a profit. We talk every week with content creators, people that are creating the films. We talk with people like OWC to learn about the latest hardware and software technology and plug-in manufacturers. Our goal is to enable people who are trying to earn a living or be serious about their hobby to understand how the hardware and software and business of filmmaking come together so you can create something that's successful in your own right.
You get fantastic guests on that show. Who's been some of your favorites and why? I know I don't want you to play favoritism, and I don't want you to feel like you're going to leave some people out, but they're not going to listen to the show anyways. It's okay.
My favorite guests are people who are passionate about what they do and eager to explain it to an audience, and people who enjoy sharing their journey with the rest of us. And whether that's a, a hardware developer that developed this really cool way of shooting video with an iPad, with Padcaster, whether it's a woman who is a documentary filmmaker that wants to explain how she makes money doing documentary films, whether it's an editor that talks about how he color graded Oz the Great and Beautiful, or whether it's a reality TV show producer that goes into the business of how you make money creating reality TV for major cable networks. What I'm interested in are people who really understand what they're doing and are willing to share that understanding with others with enthusiasm and with passion. And we have been incredibly fortunate. And most of the guests that we've had on the show have fallen into that category. I like talking to people that enjoy sharing what they've learned with others. And that's been the hallmark of the guests that we've invited.
In my life, I've had a few different careers. And a few of them was very... Let me put it this way. There were some industries that I worked in where if you didn't know what you didn't know, they're not going to teach you. It was kind of privileged information, and you just had to sink or swim. You had to figure it out for yourself. When I've done video productions, which I used to do quite a bit, I found that the people that were also into video productions were very sharing people, that there really wasn't any secrets, that the community that surrounded this industry seemed to be very giving and very sharing and very supportive of the brand new user. Do you find that to be true as well? And if so, why?
I think the industry is willing to help people who have the courage to ask questions. And the industry is quite willing to let people who think they know it all drown under their own weight.
Yeah.
If you're willing to say, I don't know, explain this to me, most people in our industry will help. If you come in, on the other hand, and say, I know everything, and don't bother me, I'm the director, and you're just crew, they are quite happy to watch you just completely fall apart and will take notes and document the process of you self-destructing.
Well, I think the second half of that is probably true with most industries, but I don't want to say most industries is true with the first thing you said, that they're willing to help those who ask, because I've experienced it firsthand. When I worked for the post office, for instance, way back at the end of the 80s, it was very difficult to get the veteran mail carriers to really give you good tips. They were more concerned with you slowing down and not doing their route when they're not there, when you're subbing. They don't want you to do it too fast. They almost would sabotage you.
You know, I think that varies by industry. One of my college jobs that I still have great fondness for is I worked as a brakeman on the railroad for a summer.
So did I.
My goal was to avoid derailing trains, and I mostly succeeded. And and there I found that the people that I talked to were quite willing to sort of take me under their wing and explain stuff that would avoid having both of us get killed.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I think it varies by industry, it varies by your manner of asking questions, perhaps, and it varies by the people that you work with. So I'm not willing to say that this is an exclusive benefit of the...
No, but I have found that they're very giving in this industry. They're very giving, and I would say more so than most of the... I would say podcasting in general, especially when it first started, that was a very giving industry. Everybody kind of banded together and to help. And I found that video production, I never found anybody who wasn't willing to lend a hand to give you a piece of advice to tell you that, you know, if you did this, it would be a lot easier. And you go, wow, that was great. Thank you.
Well, I think another reason for that is everybody is freelance. Nobody works staff anymore.
That's true, too.
So you never know if the person they're helping today is going to turn around and get the job tomorrow. So there's some enlightened self-interest going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're podcasting... kind of what's your goal? I mean, who's your target audience?
My target audience is a 30-year-old filmmaker,
mm-hmm.
who is way undercapitalized, trying to figure out how to make good decisions with their budget, trying to figure out how they can get their story produced, and desperately searching for authoritative information that they can trust. This is a huge deal. On the internet, as they say, nobody knows if you're a dog. one of the things that my company works really hard, and I work really hard at, is providing accurate, authoritative, timely information that you can trust. We don't work in the pocket of any particular company. There are companies that we recommend, there are companies that we don't recommend. We try to help you make informed business decisions by being as independent a voice as we can be, given the fact that all of us have opinions, and being willing to change our opinion as new information comes to light. As I learn something different, I'm quite willing to say, oh, you know, this is what I believed then, it was incorrect, this is what I believe now, and being willing to admit that you've learned something new, which a lot of people are not willing to do. For me, what is critical that people see us as is someone that's doing the very best they can to provide information that is accurate and trustworthy, and to correct that information when it's proven to be that new information supersedes it. The industry needs an independent voice. If all they hear about OWC, for instance, is from OWC, OWC is a great company. It's owned by a great guy. Larry O'Connor and I have had several conversations, and I respect him tremendously. But OWC is never going to tell bad things about itself. That's not what a company does. Nobody would expect a company to report bad news. Nobody would expect OWC to do an in-depth comparison of every other storage vendor that's out there to say, hey, here we stack up and here we don't. It may, but nobody expects that of a company because that's not in the company's best interest. That's where independent voices become so critical. It's not to say that any company is good or bad, but to say, looking at this objectively, here's cool stuff about OWC, here's cool stuff about GTEC, here's cool stuff about LaCie, here's cool stuff about Akedio, here's cool stuff about CalDigit, here's cool stuff about Western Digital. Now, we'll give you all that information, and you can start to make up your own mind based upon your own needs. And without that independent voice, then it becomes a series of self-interested voices, which the end user ends up not benefiting. And I think our role in life, part of what we do, part of the goal that I have in the articles that I write and the webinars that I do, is to provide that independent voice and to avoid things like you know, rumor casting. There's an entire industry devoted to rumors.
Sure.
I'm interested in rumors, and I'm not interested in the top 10 reasons why you need to click on this image. My goal is presumptuous, because I don't have the facilities, it's presumptuous to say that I'm like Consumer Reports, which has got aggressive labs and testing. But that's a goal that I aspire to, is to try as best I can to explain, this is what I did, this is how I did it, replicate my steps, see if you come to the same answer, but to give you the tools that you need to make informed decisions. I wrote an article in my newsletter. It's the longest running newsletter that's currently being published on Final Cut 10. It's been being written for 11 years.
Wow.
Every Monday, comes out at 5 o'clock LA time every Monday. The newest issue came out today. And in the issue, I wrote an article describing how you can test your video compression to see how accurate it is. There's been a lot of buzz in the web about this is an accurate video compressor and that is not an accurate video compressor. The problem is the settings are different, and if settings change, the results change. The person writing the article was interested in getting headlines but not interested in helping anybody. So I said, here's how you can test. This is what you do. This is where you look at it. This is how you measure it. These are the settings that you use. Take a look at this. And I've had thousands of people just in the last 4 hours download that article to say, how can I test my video to make it look better? How can you not love being in a situation where you enable people to become successful?
You're a teacher, Larry. I'm listening to the passion as you talk, and it's not passionate for your own work. It's passionate for what it's enabling others to do, which is the sign of a teacher. That being said, at least that's my opinion. That being said, do you miss the creative aspects, going out there and filming and editing and having an end product that you can show people? Is that spark still there, or is it?
No. We do that every week. I've got live webinars that I do every Wednesday, which is a live streamed training, which has to be produced, recorded, and edited. We do a web series called Two Real Guys, which is an on-camera webisode that we're just wrapping up. The first 25 episodes are posted. The last 5 are in post. That's me on camera. And also enabling the shooting and directing and post of that. We are in a process of coming up with a new video-based web series. No, production is at the heart of a lot of what we do. It's my first love, and we're not about to leave it behind. It's why I can teach, is I'm in the trenches trying to figure out how to get these shows produced on time, on deadline, on budget. If all you do is sit back in an ivory tower and say, well, it's supposed to be this way, that's one thing. But if you're in there saying, I'm 5 terabytes short on storage, the system is too slow, my computer keeps crashing, help me fix this. Now, I'm dealing, just like everybody else is, up to my posterior in alligators and trying to swim out of the swamp.
You know, you're not the first person who I've talked to on this show who is a teacher, and yet it's because of what they do that allows them to teach. In other words, it's not just being a teacher. That's not what they are. They're a doer, and then they take that real world experience and teach it. And that's hard to find nowadays, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. It's easy to do, it's easy to teach, but it's very, very difficult to do and teach.
Oh, absolutely. So let me ask you one last question before you wrap up. Where do you think post-production is heading? Do you think it's going to be more mobile, or do you think we're going to be, we're still going to have the laptops, we're still going to have the desktops, or do you think it's going to go towards, I personally can't see cloud storage because it's still not going to be fast enough to pull that large files down, but do you think it's going to go more mobile, mobile devices like iPads?
I think post-production is going in 3 directions at the same time. At the consumer level, it's absolutely going to go mobile. People want to be able to shoot videos on their cell phones, edit the videos on their cell phones, and publish them to Facebook. And they don't want to have to move that stuff up to a laptop or to a computer. They want to be able to do it right then because they're not interested in quality. They're interested in communication.
Mm-hmm.
Look where I am right now with my friends at Disneyland. So we're seeing a strong trend toward mobile. Look at the new Premiere clip that Adobe released last week
right.
with the Creative Cloud update. Second thing is we're seeing a trend toward high resolution, whether it's 4K, which is the new high resolution standard, or 5K or 6K that we're seeing from RED cameras and Arri Alexas and some of the high-end Sony F series. We're seeing definitely higher resolution, but this is more for theatrical production because the web is still a 720p media. We're doing 1080, but nobody can successfully download a 4K or 5K file. The distribution isn't there yet. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't protect our assets by shooting at high resolution. So high-end post is moving toward extremely fast storage, extremely massive storage, and we're seeing that the demand for high-resolution images are just driving the storage market. Look at some of the new Thunder Bay devices that OWC has. Vast speed and the need for standard for solid-state drives to get even faster performance for multicam work. And we're also seeing a broader market of people who are coming to video editing for the first time that need more than just a simple cut it together with mobile and are not yet shooting 6K images with a RED camera. They're doing high definition and they need to figure out a way to do it professionally. This is houses of worship. This is commercial production. This is cable broadcasts. This is people that are not doing it with a crew of 25 and $1 million an episode, but are doing it on more than just a shoestring and a hopeful prayer. That I think is the big market, and that's the sweet spot for me because those are the people that are most interested in learning how to do it better.
Larry Jordan, I really want to thank you for coming on OWC Radio this week. It was a pleasure to talk to you. Anybody wanting to take your classes, I assume they should go to larryjordan.biz.
Yep, we have 2 things. We have a video training library subscription service where you get access to all of our training for one low monthly fee, or you can buy specific titles in my store and download just the training that you need for your particular software. We have, and oh, by the way, we have a YouTube channel where everything is free, Larry Jordan FCP, and everything that I write, and I've got about 1,500 technical articles on my website, everything that I write is free. The way I support the company is I sell video training, but I give away the written word.
Wow. Impressive. What about Digital Production Buzz?
Digital Production Buzz is Digital Production Buzz, all one word, digitalproductionbuzz.com.
You can, and the buzz is two Z's, B-U-Z-Z at the end.
Z-Z, digitalproductionbuzz.com. And we air a live show live as opposed to recorded because otherwise it would never get done. It's a live show every Thursday at 6 o'clock L.A. time, and you can download it from iTunes or the Digital Production Buzz website anytime thereafter.
Do you use Twitter and Facebook?
We are on Twitter and Facebook for both the Digital Production Buzz and myself. You can find me at LarryJordanFCP on both Twitter and Facebook.
I will post a link for those who didn't want to, you know, use your finger to write on the dust on your dashboard while you're driving down the highway. If you simply go to blog.maxsales.com and look for show notes number 19, OWC Radio 2.0 episode number 19, I'll have a link to everything Larry and I talked about on this segment. Larry, thanks for so much for being here. I really do appreciate it, and best of luck, and I hope I see you at NAB.
You can count on us for NAB. We're going to be doing live audio and video broadcasting. We're doing 14 hours of programming in 3.5 days. Be sure to come by the booth. Love to tell you more. It is a major production blowout. We've got a staff of 25 people we bring in, and it's just incredible. 85 interviews, audio, video, singing, dancing, lights, the whole nine yards. Love to see you there. And Tim, thanks so much for the invitation.
Thanks, Larry. Thank you.